I'm doing the interviewing this time around because she's usually interviewing me. She's a chief legal analyst for CNN. She obviously is a St. Paul native, a 2005 graduate from the University of Minnesota Law School, a 2001 graduate of Princeton University. She worked as a trial lawyer for the U.S. Department of Justice, served during both the Bush and the Obama administrations, specializing in enforcement of voting rights. She also served as an assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia and as an adjunct professor at George Washington University School of Law. She is the wonderful host, you know, of her own show, Laura Coates, and she for CNN, and she is right here with yours truly right now. I'm doing the interview tonight, Laura. How are you doing? How's everything?
Oh, I am so excited for this moment. You doing the hard lift, hopefully the heavy lifting right now. But you know what? I'm excited to join you. I love the show. I love the conversation. So I am thrilled to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Laura. And I really appreciate taking time out of your busy schedule. Thank you so much. So let's get right to it. We saw what happened at the church in St. Paul, the disruption, as some people will call it. Don Lemon has found himself in a little bit of hot water, or a lot, depending on who you listen to. He insists he was there as a journalist, but the DOJ officials have publicly suggested potential legal exposure. What do you make of all of that?
You know, I have to tell you, when I went home after George Floyd, when I've been home after the Annunciation school shooting, when I've been home after what happened with Renee Good, it is disorienting, I think I have to say, when you see the presence of ICE and law enforcement to the degree it is on these streets and the anger and visceral reaction not only to the shooting and killing of Renee Good, but also to what many people on the ground believe to be this complete disingenuous narrative that suggests that the entire purpose of ICE being on the ground is in line with the righteous tactics that are being described. And so I have to tell you, I saw the palpable anger, and I was not surprised that that anger has transformed and also translated into protests around the city that I personally witnessed as largely peaceable. And also witnessed as many incidents when people were taunting the officers, conflating local law enforcement with ICE agents, conflating National Guard being on the ready with stormtroopers, discussing the pure anger about an overwhelming presence that had led to lawsuits by the Attorney General in Minnesota because of a concern that it had overwhelmed the population. But I have to say, everything I witnessed, including the taunting and the throwing things at ICE agents, even in front of federal buildings, those all happened on public streets, in the public square, so to speak. I was out Correct. There as a journalist covering it. I was among protesters who were there. I was covering it for CNN, of course. And you were confined in different areas, even pushed back by law enforcement at the federal level to those public streets. So I was surprised when I saw it enter through the same lens you all did, into a church and a house of worship, not because of the premise, but because of the location. And I think that location makes a world of difference to how prosecutors look at the ability to protest. And I'll just say quickly, Stephen A.,
okay.
You know, it's one thing to be in the public street where the government can put on time, place, and manner restrictions, and they yeah. can do all sorts of things to give, as long as it's not, content specific that I'm applying my rules to you, it's neutral. But then private entities, like a business, for example, or private places, they do have some control, in fact, the utmost control over how people can enter and remain. And so it does change the equation when you're inside of a private space.
And that being said, because listen, somewhere along the way, Don Lemon and I don't have any kind of relationship with the man, but I don't want the man thrown in jail, Laura. I don't want to see him thrown behind, but I don't want him getting in that kind of trouble, you know. And he is an independent journalist, and it makes sense because obviously he spent 17 years at CNN being a journalist. So we got to give him that. The flip side to it, however, is that he was inside a church and you see the video where he's talking about them and he's going off about ICE and he's saying a lot of things about folks and he comes across more of an activist than a journalist, and people are wondering whether or not he's going to catch major heat because that's the argument that the DOJ is going to try to make. Is that a legitimate argument the DOJ can pull off against them, in your estimation, based on what you've seen?
Well, you know, first of all, I inadvertently wore black and white stripes as if I'm a jailbird right now for this interview. So I want to just say that was totally inadvertent.
You don't look like a jailbird. You don't look like a jailbird, Olara Coach. Trust me on that. You don't.
I just want to be clear. As I'm looking at myself, I'm saying, did I incite the questioning based on my appearance and wardrobe? It could be.
Not at all.
Having said that, you know what? The stripes look good. But I will say, here's an interesting tension, and I'm going to unpack it in two ways. Number one, we know that arguments that suggest that you being a journalist is fatally undermined by your readiness and willingness to offer opinion would have a detrimental precedent across the board, because we know that the evolution in many instances of journalism, where you're providing information, can be construed as, or is actually directed as, at some entities, as opinion journalism, opinionated topic. So I think to suggest that one is no longer a journalist or has the protection of being a part of the free press because they offer an opinion would be detrimental, I think, to many entities, number one. But number two, there is this tension about the presence of the press documenting events in real time, where the obligation of journalists to cover a story doesn't necessarily stop at the closed door. And I give you examples of this. When you have a camera, for example, say inside of the Capitol on January 6th, or you have a camera that's documenting protests along the streets, and while you are within that space, you are documenting around you as a responsible journalist. I myself was pepper bomb or tear gas, whatever was deployed while on the scene, was impacted and experienced it because I was covering the protest, not a part of the protest. There's a tension there between the allowance of it. But I will say the reason why this presents a particular issue is because of the space. And this is where the FACE Act comes in, as even a, without going into the details of individual people who may or may not be identified or targeted by law enforcement, according to statements by Secretary Noem and the like. The FACE Act is where everyone's going with this. And that's a, you know, fancy acronym, but here's what it means. It means that you're not allowed to threaten or intimidate or use force or other means to try to impact or obstruct somebody's ability to either enter a reproductive health clinic, which is where it really started, or a house of worship. And the reason for that is because you want to have, especially with house of worship, you've got the discussion of the First Amendment and exercise of one's First Amendment rights. And any tactic that's used to try to suppress or intimidate that, to have a chilling effect on it, can be problematic for the First Amendment. But then you've got that tension of the free press within that same amendment space. So why I look at this as a very unique dilemma for not only one who'd be looking to investigate, but also as a guidance for press going forward. And, you know, a lot of people think they're press because they have a camera in their hand, because I'm documenting, I'm performing. Yes, right. Aren't I a journalist too? There are prescribed guidelines and regulations. But I wonder for the people out there, do you want the press to follow into a space where news is happening or stop at the door and in order to not risk being identified?
That's a legitimate question.
Sure.
That's a legitimate question because that's what, you know, I mean, I think that if Don Lemon's smart, he listened to you and what you just said and say, hey, that's the news was happening inside, not at the door. That's why I was inside. I mean, that's a good argument. That's something that definitely should be exercised, no doubt about that. I want to know what you can tell us about what legal theories actually apply here. Trespass, disorderly conduct, the FACE Act, the KKK Act, all right, et cetera. And how do courts balance protest rights with religious freedom and the right to worship without disruption?
Think about it in this way. Your rights end where mine begin. And that's in the public space, let alone the private space. You've ever gone to the movie theater, you've gone to a restaurant, and they'll tell you no shirts, no shoes, no admission, right? Or you can revoke your license of a ticket if you're throwing popcorn at the screen or recording inside the movie theater. I'm telling you, not from personal experience, but what I have heard about, you know, these sorts of things, number one. So you can think about that. A private entity tells you, you ain't got to go home, but you cannot be here. And you, if you're in my home, you're in my space, it's my rules. So with that in mind, you got to think about these two competing interests. One is everyone's right to be in the quintessential public spaces. I can be on this sidewalk. I can be screaming up to the high heavens, my policy differences, the things I think you're doing wrong. I have a right to petition the government to redress my grievances, even if that means that my petition, so to speak, is me holding up a sign in front of the street, in front of the quintessential public forum, the White House, right? That sidewalk. But then there's the private spaces where I am allowed to have some sanctuary. I'm allowed to have some distance between everyone's welcome to, no one can come unless I say so. And so the FACE Act is about that secondary part. It's about saying that we hold, you know, quite in a precious way, we hold it very important to be able to exercise our freedom of worship and beyond, our freedom to access reproductive health clinics, although that's interesting given the course of events in terms of abortion rights to this country, but we still hold the ability to access people with whom we are going to exercise our rights to be private. And you can't come in and trample on those. I had an interesting interview with one of the organizers, Nikema Levy Warren, who was inside of that church. I interviewed her a couple days ago, and I asked her the question of why she wanted to go inside as opposed to being outside. She relayed to me, and I'll paraphrase her commentary. She relayed to me on air that it was a duty she felt as being a Christian to identify a kind of hypocrisy with being a member of ICE and also being somebody who had a ministerial role inside of the church. And when I questioned her about
what this pastor was being accused of.
Yeah, when I questioned her and of course the DHS does not want to confirm or deny the presence of that person as a member of that church because they don't want to dox somebody and they have some privacy interests there. But the idea here of saying I had a right to go in and tell people how I felt and warn people about the fact that one among you is a hypocrite, or one among you I don't believe is acting in line with the professed religious beliefs that he says he is, that's what she articulated. Now, I'll tell you why that's exactly something that the investigators in a civil rights division or in the investigators of a prosecutor's office are gonna hone in on. Precisely why is this reason, Stephen A? And that is, it sounds as if you are trying to impact my ability or influence my ability to be in a space of worship. And the FACE Act, along with the clinics aspect of it, was designed in part to, if not prevent that, to minimize and stop it altogether. So I think you have this investigation that's pending on all these people that will go beyond just what is, you know, said on social media, but also interviewing the members of the actual House of Worship. Going broadly from what we saw as clips to what actually was the full landscape of it. And I understand from her statements to me that they actually attended the service and then spoke up at what they thought was an appropriate time to condemn. And I do wonder what the impact of having been in attendance will impact.
Quick answer to this question. Is the man in trouble?
You know what? I think when there has been a threat made by the DHS and the Attorney General of the United States that you're on notice, I think that you are right to be concerned. Now, whether that will pan out in terms of their burden of proof and a grand jury agreeing with them, I have no prediction. But you don't want to be, as the former president of the United States, I can't believe I'm quoting Ronald Reagan here, but said, if you're explaining, you're losing. That's the same in the law. You don't want to be in the position to try to explain what you have done, because then you find yourself in a courtroom.
To remind us why we even having this discussion, why even the stuff happened in St. Paul, it's because of the shooting, the death of Renee Good. And obviously federal officials say the ICE officer who shot her suffered internal bleeding. I didn't see that. I saw it. I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? But either way you slice it, video disputes have fueled public distrust, of course. From a use of force legal standpoint, Laura Coates, what facts matter most? Imminent threat, positioning, timing of shots, etc. And what's the cleanest standard for judging reasonableness when the video is unclear or incomplete?
The phrase kill or be killed. If you feel as though you have to act or you yourself will be killed or have serious bodily harm, officers, because the Supreme Court's deference have said that we're going to judge that belief, whether it's reasonable, according to what another officer who is reasonably in a similar situation might view it. That's important here because they're not judging from what you and I watching this as quote unquote laymen would be, but what other officers might believe, because they are the ones who we expect to make split second decisions and have experience in these very difficult circumstances. But here's why it's difficult to understand the absence of an investigation of the officer who shot and killed Renee Good, because it's not a hypothetical officer that was on the scene as well. There were other officers on the scene, and they did not, from any vantage point that I've seen, draw, let alone fire their weapons, even though they too would have had a duty to protect another person who was in imminent harm or lethal harm. So that reasonableness standard, I think, in many ways strengthens a need to investigate whether or not that officer was reasonable to believe kill or be killed. And by the way, Stephen A., that's for every single shot that was fired, not just the first one. Right. It's every single shot. And finally, when you cannot know the intent in someone's mind, because he's not going to say what he was believing and thinking, you have right. to look at what they do after as well, as part of consciousness of guilt. Did the officer who fired the weapon, believing he was in lethal harm's way, or that the community would be harmed with this person going, what did the officer do after to ensure that the threat that he believed was neutralized? Did he follow the car? Did he attempt to render aid? Did he attempt to understand whether the person had a weapon mm-hmm. on them? Was that vehicle going to be used to harm somebody else, according to him? Did other officers do that? Or was it a matter of shooting out of reasonableness or anger? That's all part of what should be an investigation.
Insurrection Act. I wanted to get to this because I've seen you covered, you know, you've covered talk of invoking the Insurrection Act in response to unrest. What are the legal thresholds a president has to meet, according to your knowledge? And what would be the bright line slash red flags, per se, that signal it's being used as a political tool rather than a lawful last resort public safety measure?
When you think of the Insurrection Act, you want to think about an overwhelming emergency where the local law enforcement cannot control it. It has become so problematic as to overwhelm the presence of law enforcement, or be so overwhelming in number, force, or threat, or scope, such that the local law enforcement cannot reasonably be expected to control it. I mean, you think back for in the civil rights era, it was invoked at that point in time, not at the request of a governor, when you had people trying to ensure that segregation would continue and that they were not going to abide by the federal law to actually integrate. Well, at that point, the president of the United States would say, had said in more than one instance, I'm going to go in, I'm going to invoke the Insurrection Act because I have an emergency where there are people in this country whose rights can no longer be protected or ensured and secured by local law enforcement because they weren't helping to do so. That's one instance. The other instance, which is far more helpful and palatable, to the governor, is when the governor requests it. And that happened following the Rodney King verdict, when you had the riots in Los Angeles that completely overwhelmed the city, damages to the millions of dollars, yeah. businesses burned down, an overwhelming presence of people who were overwhelming local law enforcement. In that instance, they said, please, I need the help. And it was invoked. Again, the common thread for both those instances is local law enforcement either couldn't or wouldn't help preserve the rights of people in the area and secure the public good and calm. What's happening in Minnesota, the lawsuit by Keith Ellis and the attorney general and the governor and the mayors there have talked about that their law enforcement is not overrun by the people of the community, but they are outnumbered by the ICE agents to the tune of thousands, about 600 Minneapolis police officers on the roster, not just in actual work, compared to about 3,000 ICE agents who are on the scene, which means, of course, that you have protesters who are responding to ICE agents. Local law enforcement need to secure the areas and secure, at that point, the protection of even the presence of federal law enforcement, and then still do their jobs. So this is, by the standard that we've seen across our country alone, it has not risen to the level that local law enforcement is overwhelmed by the actual conduct of the people. but they argue overwhelmed by the conduct of law enforcement who they want to stay in their federal immigration lane. This is really the argument that people are raising with respect to Trump dangling the Insurrection Act, because there always runs a risk where states' rights and the ability of local law enforcement to control their community will be trampled, even by, if you wanted to be gracious, the most well-intentioned federal officers. And if you wanted to be, what some believe, realistically cynical, those who do not serve the public good.
Concerned at all, last question here, concerned at all about the subpoenas that have been handed down to the mayor, to the governor? What, can you speak to the level of concern, if any, if any should exist at all? Yeah. As it pertains to that subject matter?
Well, if the intent of issuing the subpoenas is to chill the political speech that an elected official is entitled to have on behalf of their constituents, then we should all be concerned. If the goal is to, which it has been so far as the stated subpoena, to request documents, information, not from the person, but from the offices about any coordination of information that they say was conspiratorial in nature to stop federal law enforcement, then state officials ought to be concerned if they have engaged in that sort of conspiracy. However, what we have seen to date so far, and I'm not privy to all of the information that obviously the Department of Justice would have, but what is reported and what my own reporting has uncovered is that the statements that have been made are protected political First Amendment activity speech where you can disagree with the president's directives. You can disagree with what even your own fellow mayors or fellow members of Congress are saying. What you can't do is engage in an activity to obstruct or intimidate and prevent law enforcement activity. But simply speaking about what you believe to be right is part of why we elect our officials to advocate on behalf of what we're saying. Because if you were to follow that to logical conclusion, can you imagine the day that someone says, well, a fellow member of your own party has spoken out against your policies? They don't like it. Does that mean that you've conspired to obstruct their agenda, or are you speaking out about it? That's the tension.
Laura Coates, I know you got a show to do. You got to get on out of here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you
for being here for me. You know I'm always here for you.
I love it.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to watching you tonight on CNN. Go ahead and do your thing.
Love you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All righty. The one and only Laura Coates. She's doing a fantastic job, and she knows her stuff. Make no mistake about that. She is the one and only Laura Coates. Got her own show here on SiriusXM POTUS Radio, by the way. Not to mention the fact that she's on CNN every night. Every weeknight, 11 o'clock, Laura Coates Show. She's doing her thing, no doubt about it. Very, very proud of her. 866-967-6887 is the number to call. It's 866-96-POTUS. You're listening live to Straight Shooter with Stephen A. Back with your calls and more in a minute.